Yeah, I guess I have to announce this thing, right? So, yes, I do. Today is Wednesday, May 3rd. The year is 2006. The time is 8:30 p.m. This is for posterity.
Okay.
And I am Derek Wang, and I and Shira Bretman are here in the Mather Senior Common Room at Harvard University, interviewing violinist Lin Chang about various matters Bernstein-related, including but not limited to his early work and the piano trio. So, take it away, Mr. Chang.
Well, you want me to talk about the piano trio?
You can talk about...
Okay.
Well, sure.
I actually discovered or heard about the piano trio about 3 or 4 years ago, when I came across a program in which was to be played the violin sonata by Leonard Bernstein. And I'd never heard of this piece before, and I was wondering, wow, I didn't know this even existed. And so I went and did a little bit of research. I went to the Leonard Bernstein website and found out that indeed it was a work that had been written, and it had been written for a person named Raphael Hillier, who I later found out at the time was a violinist. Of course, we know Raphael Hillier as the founding violist of the Juilliard String Quartet. And of course, and he's a friend of mine. And so I called up Rafe, and I said, tell me about this fiddle sonata. I'd like to play it, if possible. And he said, well, I've got the music, but listen, can you not play it? And I said, why? He said, well, I'm going to be turning 90 this year, and I'm going to be having the violin sonata done in honor of, you know, because it was written for me, and it's going to be done at this concert in Payne Hall. But what you can do instead is the piano trio. Why don't you do that instead? And I said, piano trio? I never heard of the piano trio. He said, yes, he wrote it the same year or before the fiddle sonata, and it's a wonderful piece. I've played it. So if you have problems getting the music, I can lend you my parts, but they're all scribbly and barely legible. So I did some research, and I actually found that they actually had been published. I'm not exactly sure how I got them, but I got an edition of the parts. And it's actually not only published, but it's been recorded. It's been recorded by the On Trio. And so I actually managed to hear it as well as play it. And I played it. The school that I teach, the Boston Conservatory, actually had a Bernstein year 3 years ago, and I ended up playing it then for the first time, and I actually ended up playing it again several times after that. I think it's a charming work. I've done a little bit of research as to the what I think is the idea for the inspiration for that work. I was reading actually Peiser's book, and there's an incident about Bernstein and his composition class. He was in that composition seminar taught by Walter Piston. And I think Harold Shapiro, who we interviewed, I don't know if we talked to you about that, but he was in that class as well as Raphael Hillier. In that class, one of the first assignments was simply to write a fugue. And Bernstein, but the catch of that was that the subject of the fugue had to be something that you wrote. You did not write. It could be any theme, melody, whatever. Just something that you did not write. And so when Bernstein came in eventually with his fugue, he used the long, slow melody from the Saint-Saëns cello concerto. I think it goes... So, of course, they played this in class, and when Piston heard this, he said, you know, Mr. Bernstein, this is not an appropriate subject for fugue. And according to the book, he quotes Shapiro as saying that Bernstein slammed his hand on the desk and said, well, I think it's appropriate. So you know that even then the kid had some kind of chutzpah. So apparently this next assignment that came later in the year was an assignment, and Hillier tells me the story. The assignment was given on a Monday, and this time the assignment was sort of open. You could write about anything, you know, concerto, sonata, symphony, oratorio, opera, whatever. But it was the start of a long-term project. Simon was given on a Monday, and Rafe tells me we walked into class on Wednesday carrying our scraps of paper. You know, we scribbled down 10, 15, 20 bars of whatever ideas we had. Lenny, he comes in with this entire piano trio, you know? And if you look at the piano trio, you look at the first movement, and it's all fugues. And my idea is that because he had such a kind of failure with this earlier compositional assignment, which was to write a fugue, that he tried to remedy that by, in this piano trio, in the first movement, by writing a substantial and probably more correct fugue. And when you listen to it, you'll find out that it actually is much more fugal and certainly even Bachian in its scope, and a little pompous, but you know, that's what else to expect from a 19-year-old Harvard undergraduate. And so I think personally that is Bernstein's answer to Piston's, you know, criticism. There are three movements. The second movement is a wonderful, humorous, witty, delightful scherzo in which you can almost hear slight elements of or germs of the future tunes he was to write for his Broadway shows. You know, I think it's a delight to play. The audience always chuckles after you finish it, and it's that's a lot of fun.
Great. If I could one moment, if we might pause just for a second
sure.
to check our equipment, that would be great. I don't think
recording.
Okay.
Are we on? Okay.
So
what am I going to?
I was about the scherzo, the second.
Oh yeah, the scherzo is a delight. If you analyze it, I don't know if I ever took the time to analyze it that much, but I think it's in a somewhat unconventional form. But you'll find out if you look at it. It's not ABA form. I think it's like an ABCBA thing. But it's a little bit different. It's like an arch form. But it goes ABCBA or something like that. It's somewhat unique in that aspect. The last movement is a actually begins quite dreamily. If I don't know if that's such a word, but it begins very. It's almost French-like, which is not surprising considering that Bernstein's favorite work at the time was Ravel. Didn't he play the Ravel piano concerto?
Yeah.
He played the Ravel concerto, which he loved. And boy, I hear the beginning of that last movement. I hear a little bit of Ravel in there. But then it that's just a slow introduction, and then it goes into a much more substantial theme, which just goes on. It's not that the last movement doesn't really develop that much, but it has a nice catchy tune to it, and ends with a big flurry at the end. And so that's basically the my suspicion is he didn't write it in 2 days, that he had this going since we later found out that he wrote this for the Madison Trio. He wrote this for some friends. So I have a feeling that he had been sort of had this bubbling or percolating in his mind, and then simply finished it off in the last couple of days and submitted it as that composition assignment. So in my opinion, this is his, at least according to the Leonard Bernstein website, even though they call it Juvenalia, I like to call it his unofficial Opus 1, because that's his first complete composition. And I think it stands pretty nicely by itself. It works pretty well. I think the other thing that Mr. Hillier was telling me about, and when you talk to him, you'll find out, there was an event in Bernstein's life at the time. The Boston Symphony used to play, I guess, runouts in Sanders Theater every couple of concerts, or they would play how many, two or three times at Sanders. So it was a great opportunity for undergraduates to go hear them, or college kids, or anybody in Cambridge to hear them.
Could you explain
what
for the uninitiated such as I?
What?
Or what a runout is?
A runout?
Yeah.
Well, it's anything that's outside your home base.
Oh.
For example, I belong to the Boston Chamber Society, and we play our concerts at Jordan, mostly at Jordan Hall, and we play them sometimes at Sanders. But a runout is like
a
one an away game. You go out for you run out to like Lincoln Sudbury, and you play a concert there, and then you come back the next day and play it at Jordan Hall. You know, that's a run out. You run out and run through the concert, usually the day before or so that you have it. So the Boston Symphony would have these run outs, and they would have, now I think they run to New York and play. They play at Carnegie Hall. But at the time, they had a series at Sanders, and Bernstein had, I guess he shared a subscription with some friends, and I guess it was his turn or something to go there. So he went there with his friend Raphael Hillier to this concert, and that was the concert in which the Dimitri Metropolis was conducting. And it was they had played the C-sharp minor string quartet, 131, I believe, by Beethoven. And on that concert also was the Ravel piano concerto, which we know earlier was one of his favorite pieces, the piece that he played. And I think on that concert, Metropolis, who was a conductor, was also a great pianist. He also was a he played that concerto and conducted from the piano. And it was a great concert. And it was the concert, according to Hillier, that inspired Bernstein to become a conductor. At the time, he was a serious pianist. And so he said, I'll never forget the expression that we both had after that concert. We were just sitting there, absolutely quiet. We didn't want to break the silence because the atmosphere that had been created by that orchestra was so unbelievable. It was one of those great concerts at which you just can't say anything afterwards. And even years later, when I'd run into Bernstein, you know, he would say to me, "Wow, wasn't that a great concert?" You know, and so I think the other thing that Hillier told me was that Bernstein had a reputation of they thought, well, he's, you know, have you heard of this kid Bernstein? He will never amount to anything because he's got his hands in too many things. He's doing this, he's doing that, he's running a show, he's playing piano here, and he's brilliant, but he's got his fingers in too many pies, and he's spread out too thin, and we don't think anything's going to happen of him. So I had no idea that he'd become the great figure that he ended up being. You want me to continue on with my reminiscences? Or just stick with the piano trio, or his Harvard days, or his early youth?
We do a lot of things, but just take one more short break for a number of reasons.
Sure, okay.
Okay, so, as we were at the piano trio, just you mentioned that you had performed it. If you could possibly just tell us a little bit about your performance, the details.
The performance?
Well, when was it? Where was it?
Oh, I've played the piece already 4 or 5 times now. I played it again 3 years ago at the Boston Conservatory, which is having a Bernstein year. And then I played it later that summer at a summer festival in Middle Massachusetts called Musicorda. The cellist at the time was Peter Wrightho. The pianist was Michael Adcock.
Can you spell Wrightho?
R-E-J-T-O.
Nice.
Regto. Okay. And then Michael Adcock, who actually went to Peabody. Yeah. And then I played it. I think I played it once at Payne Hall. I was invited by one of my students to give a recital at Payne Hall, and so I played it there with an artist diploma student whose name actually I can't, Agnieszka, and I don't remember her last name, but unfortunately it's Agnieszka, who's from Poland, and then the pianist's name was Jung Ja Kim, J-U-N-J-A-K-I-M, Jung Ja Kim,
J-U-N-G,
yeah, who's on the yeah,
J-A-K-I-M.
And then I...
She's on the
Faculty of the Boston Conservatory. Nice. We did it. We actually did it there. We did it once at the St. Paul Academy. I've played it around a lot. And then I recently played it once in Tucson, Arizona, at a festival there, at the Tucson... Actually, that was just in February. Right. The pianist there was Lydia Artemu, and the cellist again was Peter Wrighto. So so I played it about five times or so, you know. So it's a lot of fun.
So yes, and this has all been in the past few years.
Within the past 3 years, yeah, sure. 3 years.
And I guess I'm wondering, this doesn't seem to be very well known, relatively speaking, right?
Oh no, people who come up to me say, wow, that's a delightful piece, I never heard of it before. I didn't even know he wrote a piano trio. Of course, nobody's aware of the piece.
I see.
Yeah, it's completely, it hasn't reached the public domain yet at all.
How do you present it? I mean, is it sort
presented?
Of, does it?
I actually, to tell you the truth, before most of the performances, I've actually given a talk and called it his unofficial Opus 1. And I think most audiences love to hear the story about how it was originally a composition assignment that he wrote, you know, that he completed as an undergraduate, and that, and they like to hear the story, at least that I like to tell, about how he had problems with fugues, fugal
right.
writing in the beginning, and how the first movement is a fugue, and hopefully that conflict he had had, whatever he had had with Professor Piston, was resolved, and he still, you know, later years, as you know, he thought very fondly of all his music professors here. So that's all I ever say is you know, how that piece came into being.
Does its position in sort of official juvenilia affect how you present it, or how it...
Oh, I never call it juvenilia. I simply refer to it as his, you know, Opus 1, basically. It's his first complete, I believe,
right.
Until I hear otherwise, I'm willing to call it his unofficial Opus 1.
How do you feel about the piece in terms of standing alone in the repertoire? Do you feel that's something that you can just put on a program? Or?
Well, I've done it, played it on a regular
right.
program with other pieces, and I think it stands pretty nicely. And I don't think, you know, programming is a very, very complex art, but I think for what it is, I think it's delightful. I think audiences generally tend to react to it very positively. I think it really helps to know in general, and specifically with Mr. Bernstein, the kind of aspects that go into it. For example, we know that this is a very youthful work. We know that it has a kind of upbeat, you know, quality to it. And so when you're playing it, you tend to imagine yourself as a, you know, having a lot more youthful energy and a kind of sort of pseudo-naive quality about it, because it obviously isn't tremendously sophisticated, but has a kind of pseudo-naive quality that just stands on its own. It's very honest music, and it's just you try to make it as delightful and convincing as possible. You know, that I think is the role of the performer. It's as far as that work is concerned. You can't approach it like some kind of, you know, late Beethoven string quartet or even Schubert, something like that. It's not like that. It's very fresh, and it's very you know, youthful. So, yeah.
No, sorry.
Go ahead.
Are there influences that you detect or that you think are significant or that affect your interpretation of the piece when you're playing it and or studying it? You mentioned Ravel slightly.
Right. There is that Ravel. I know that when we play the fugue, it's always good to, you know, in any kind of fugue, it's always good to think about Bach, you know, because he is clearly the greatest of them all. So we try to, every time I've played the fugue, I've always tried to think in terms of a Bachian profile, all about structure and presenting the subject as it is, and whatever episodes and whatever transitions there are. And it's actually written fairly classically that way. And so you think of that in that style, and I think it helps the performance. there are moments in when it comes to a complete climax in the first and even in all movements in which it has all these big climaxes, and you say to yourself, well, there's a part in the last movement where the, the second movement, when the piano goes and the violin fiddle comes and I just can't help thinking that this is basically some kind of, you know, hasty pudding song or something, you know, that it has this oompa 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 quality, and you think, oh, well, this is great for, you know, this would be a great hasty pudding, you know, song to use, you know, with that kind of wit and humor there, you know, it's basically a rah rah college theme song kind of there, you know, I think that's it for the piano trio. I think that's the best I can think of it.
Are there any particular challenges you've
technical?
Up? Well, just
musical?
Musical, something. I'm just wondering.
Not really. There's nothing really particularly tricky about it. I mean, there are some kind of fundamental pseudo jazzy rhythms that come in and out, but they're not. It's nothing compared to, you know, what we're used to. As Mr. Hillier told me later on, his next work that he completed for Mr. Hillier, the Fiddle Sonata, is very different from this trio in that it is a much more serious work. I think Bernstein is trying to become much more serious and as a composer, and I know that Hillier told me that. In that work, they were all quite obsessed with Hindemith at the time. And I didn't even know that because I'd heard the work performed before I spoke to him about it. And that was the first thing I heard was, oh my God, there's a lot of Hindemith in here. And he told me subsequently, yes, we were all very obsessed with Hindemith at the time. And that sonata shows it, you know. So that piece doesn't have nearly the kind of upbeat, humorous, youthful quality that the piano trio does. That's clearly a more fun piece, you know, so to speak, you know, than the, and of course, when he reaches to his official, generally considered official Opus 1, and that is the clarinet sonata, that is clearly influenced by jazz. That has a big jazz following. And I think it was shortly after that that he began his work on the Jeremiah Symphony, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was, and you can see that he's really maturing as a composer at that time. Did you read his senior thesis? Did you make any sense of it?
I think so.
About F, I actually just skimmed through it too. I mean, I think his overall conclusion was is that there really wasn't any. The idea was ethnicity in music.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Well, I think American nationalism.
Yeah, a nationalism in music.
Being rooted in
Right. And he says there really isn't any such thing. And he, for a long time in his life, he said, no, nationalism doesn't even exist. And at the time, one of the biggest pieces of the time was this piece, was a piano trio by Copland called Vitebsk. And he quotes the Vitebsk. He says, well, possibly Vitebsk might have a little bit of the Jewish flavor in there. But no other piece has and I remember I once read a pamphlet that he wrote on the New World Symphony, and he analyzed the whole symphony from bar by bar, talking about how not one single, what's so American about this? There's not one single fragment phrase, even that beautiful second movement. He said that could be at home in downtown Prague. What are we talking about? And possibly the only thing is the last movement at the very end when the cellos and basses go bum 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 bum. Well, okay, that's probably boogie woogie. But that, other than that, nothing else is American about that entire thing. You know, even in his first, he had a thing about that. In his very very first Young People's Concert, I don't know if you've ever heard that. Saw that. I saw that. I grew up watching the Young People's Concerts. You know, I came of age during the 60s when Bernstein started giving those young people's concerts. And the very, very, very first show, he gets up there and plays and has the orchestra play the William Tell Overture. You know, and of course, at the time, the biggest TV show that everyone was watching was a show called The Lone Ranger, and which used that music. And he stopped after 20 bars, and he said, "What was that, boys and girls?" And they all screamed out, "The Lone Ranger!" He said, "Wrong!" And of course, the question behind that whole TV show was, "What is music?" He was trying to answer the music. And the conclusion that he gave was, music isn't about anything. It's just notes, and you can make it whatever you want it to be. There is no problem. Of course, I don't know why he said that, because almost every piece he's written is about something, you know?
That's
true. So there's a lot of hypocrisy in the guy's life. Almost every one of his pieces has a certain programmatic element to it, but he maintained, at least in those days, that there was no programmatic anything to anything. Programmatic element to any of his music. Later, when he, when I was an undergraduate, he came and gave the Norton lectures, and I remember he came to Music 180, and he did, and he listened to a Schubert piano trio, and the cellist was a freshman named Yo-Yo Ma. There was a piano quartet by Mozart, and he was working with the piano quartet, and of course it got around that Bernstein was going to be visiting this class, and so a lot of people came in. There were a lot of visitors, a lot of distinguished visitors who none of us knew who they were, but he started talking about how to play the Mozart in his sort of Bernsteinian manner, and one of the visitors raised his hand. He said, "Listen, I don't really think that you should be playing it in this fashion. You should be playing it with less vibrato. You should be playing it in a much more, period fashion. Less vibrato, tapered phrases. And Bernstein politely disagreed with them, and they got into this big row, on and on and on. And finally, Bernstein decided to pull rank by saying, "Listen, if there's just no way I could ever conceive of this piece. In fact, if I was to get in front of the New York Philharmonic, there's no way in the world that I would conduct this piece in this way." That sort of, it was quiet in the room, and the guy just sat down. And afterwards, someone came to me and says, "Did you know who that person was that was arguing with Bernstein?" And I said, "No, that was Franz Borgen, the great, great period recordist who had gotten this." And of course, that was just the beginning of the period instrument movement, and he was arguing for the fact that Mozart should be played in a less romanticized style. But you know, Bernstein wouldn't have any of that. Later on in the year, the class gave a concert, a 180 concert, and in those days, the president, who was Derek Bach, loved music, and he had the 180 class come and give a concert at his house, and he would invite various faculty and probably potential donors to come to the concert. And at this concert, Bernstein came, and he was sitting in the front row next to Bach, and I played on this concert, the Schoenberg Fantasy, which is the last piece Schoenberg wrote. And of course, I had been studying this with the professor of the class at the time, named Leon Kirshner, who of course studied with Schoenberg. And on that concert was the same Schubert trio from that Bernstein had listened to, with Yo-Yo Ma as the cellist. So I played the Schoenberg, and then after intermission came the Schubert. And during the Schubert, I was sitting there listening to it, and all of a sudden I heard this big snap, this big crack. I said, "What was that?" I thought somebody's string had broken. And I looked up and I saw they kept playing. And what had happened was that Yo-Yo was playing so vigorously that he actually hit his cello and had knocked a corner of the cello off the instrument. Okay? And so you hear the snap, he actually hit the instrument. And afterwards, I was talking to Yo-Yo, and Bernstein came up to us and said, "Listen," he said to me, he talked to me and he said, "Listen, I love the way you played, but every time I hear Schoenberg, I just want to run to the nearest window and jump out." He said. And then he said to Yo-Yo, he said, "Listen, Yo-Yo, I love the way you said, to yourself when you knocked the corner of your instrument off. Yo-Yo started cursing a little bit to himself. And Brinson said, I love the way you just started cursing yourself when you knocked the corner of the instrument off. Then he walked away. And at the time, he had yet to give his first Norton lecture, or maybe he had given one already, one or two of them. And I had no idea that actually what he said to me was essentially the subject of his thesis for the Norton lectures, that music sort of ended with Mahler, and that he foresaw a new tonality coming from the chaos of atonality and serial music. That was his whole thesis for it, and that's why when he said that to me, I had no idea that that was what he was thinking of for his entire Norton series. And those are my fondest memories of Mr. Bernstein.
So you were in music 180.
Yeah, I was in 180.
What year was that? Was just
well, that was the 73. That was 73. That was the fall of it was 72, 73. So it was either fall of 72 or spring of 73. You know, after that concert, there was a party, Bernstein was there standing next to Earl Kim, who was one of the professors here. He's since passed away. Wonderful professor. And Earl was going on and on about the piece he thought was the greatest piece ever written, and that was Figaro, Marriage of Figaro. And it was just Figaro this, Figaro that, the greatest, on, 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 on. And Bernstein's quietly listening. And finally Bernstein stops and says, oh, for goodness sakes, Earl, it's all Broadway. That was it. I just thought that was the greatest comment. It's all Broadway. So those are just my just about all my personal memories of Bernstein, you know, of those years and my experience with the piano trio. Do you have any other questions?
The violins, now that you mentioned that, have you played that one as well?
No, I have the music to it and I've heard it, but I've never played it. But it's actually a very nice work, as I said earlier, a very different kettle of fish from the piano trio. The piano trio is a little bit more accessible and more you know, delightful. It's clearly it's not a fluff piece, but it's a more upbeat piece. It's a nice piece. The fiddle sonata, I think Bernstein makes an attempt to be a more, you know, a more serious composer. He's making an attempt to be as we know, very, 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 very influenced by Hindemith. And of course, we don't think of Hindemith as having a great sense of humor. So I think he was into that, you know. Of course, we know that Bernstein, his whole life, wanted to be taken as a serious composer. Anyway, he was always, even at the end of his life, one of the members of the Israeli Philharmonic once said to me, you know, he was nearing his end. He was close to the end of his conducting career. He was conducting the Israeli Philharmonic, and this violinist told me, he said, you know, Mr. Bernstein came to me and said, you know, I just so want to be remembered for more than just writing West Side Story. I mean, I really want somebody to like my music, be taken as a more serious composer than simply just writing, you know, just this one great, great, you know, as good as West Side Story is, you know. And, you know, that's all there is. The only other story that I can tell you about Bernstein, if you really want to know, it involves his final day on this earth. And that was told to me by the composer Bright Sheng, who is a wonderful Chinese-American composer. But Bright had been working with Bernstein Bernstein had asked him to orchestrate his arias and barcarolles, I think one of his final works, and make it into an orchestra. And so Bright was bringing it in and to him. And he went and delivered. He'd been seeing Bernstein pretty regularly. And, of course, by this time, Bernstein was very sick. And he called to see if he was taking any visitors. And they said, well, why don't you come? He's not feeling too well now, but why don't you come later on in the day? This is the day he died. Why don't you come around 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon? So he showed up, and Bernstein was there, and he was alive. He was sitting there, and they let him in. And so they bring him to to visit Bernstein, and there, and he describes me, he said, there Bernstein was sitting there in front of the television watching live from Lincoln Center, and on the air was Yo-Yo playing the Rachmaninoff piano sonata with Jeff Kahane. And there's Bernstein sitting there with an oxygen tube into his nostrils, and in one hand a glass of scotch, and then in the other hand a cigarette. This is the scene he just had. And he's listening to Yo-Yo play the Rachmaninoff sonata, and he says, "Huh, there's a lot of Schumann in that piece." That was his comment. I don't know where that came. And then he talks, and they talk a little bit about the transcription, and then that Bright was doing, and then he leaves. And then right after, as he was leaving, he ran into, I think, Adolph Green, who was one of his childhood friends, who wanted to see him. But then they didn't let him in because Bernstein had a little bit of a relapse. At the time when Bright saw him, he was quite lucid and he was actually thinking quite well. But apparently what had happened was is that went into some kind of convulsion. The doctor was there and they gave him a shot. And just as they gave him a shot, his last words were, "What's this?" And then he just collapsed and died. And that was it, you know. They were giving him some sort of shot to try to, and that's the story that you know, Bright tells me. So, any more questions?
Well, I guess, have you played performed any other Bernstein works?
His greatest work is The Serenade, which I have looked at. That's a pretty good piece, you know. I think it's generally considered to be his best, you know, serious work. I think it's a pretty good piece, you know, and I think he hasn't written much more. I mean, other than the trio and the violin sonata and the Serenade, there's not much more for a solo violin. There's certainly no chamber music. Primarily, I do chamber music, and that's all there is for chamber music, unless you wanted to transcribe, you know, some of his, you know, show tunes.
Mentioned having transcribed the clarinet sonata for viola.
Oh, right. And of course, Yo-Yo transcribed it for cello.
Right.
And he told me that he had asked Bernstein if he could do it, and Burns said, "Well, sure, why not?" You know, and so he's actually recorded it on recording with his Made in America CD. He plays the transcription of the clarinet sonata for cello. So that's I wish he had written more for violin or solo violin or chamber music, but he never wrote a string quartet or a piano trio, any of that kind of stuff. So we just, that's all we have to go with.
You know? Do you have any plans, do you think, to be performing the violin sonata at any point in time?
Not in the foreseeable future, no. Although I probably will look at it again, seriously, you know. Great.
Is there anything I haven't asked you that you talk about?
Shira, do you have anything?
I actually have another question.
You really? Seriously? Okay.
So there's nothing. We've covered your experience with the piano trio. Through the violin sonata, get to the piano trio.
Yeah.
About your music 180.
Right. That's much more. He's already, he's already, fully into his.
And that's still, that's a great story. Yeah. That we haven't heard so far.
Oh, the Harvard stories that I tell you, I think, are really nice about what he said to me and Yo-Yo and
Did you attend
Earl Kim. I went to a couple of them. They were very interesting. Actually, they got better as they went along, you know. You see, the ones that appear on the he was actually much more informal, and the ones that survive on the tape are all quite serious and they're all very nice. But in reality, when you went to the lectures, they were actually quite amusing, and he threw in a lot of jokes. he was once talking. I remember that he was one of the Tchaikovsky symphonies. Dum ba da da ya da dum. He starts singing "Hooray for the gay liberation," you know, like that. I just remember. So that's all I remember. But the first lecture I remember being quite complex. But as it went along, his subject and thesis was beginning to come through, and I think they became much more interesting as they went along, you know. But they were actually it was quite a year, the year that he spent here, you know. He was actually, he really got into activities. He spent a lot of time, I think he attended a lot of concerts when he was here, you know, and did a lot of things, you know.
When you were preparing these early works, did you have occasion to speak to other people who had participated in besides Mr. Hillier?
No, because I don't know of anybody else who's played this except for that recording of the On Trio, and I don't know of any other people who've played this piece.
Well, as well as
and I actually tried to actually contact Mildred Spiegel, but I was unable to. I was unsuccessful for that. Maybe you can do that.
I tried calling her, never got through.
Is she still in Boston, isn't she, or New York?
She's Westchester.
Westchester, right. You never reach her. Does she have an address, a phone?
Yeah, I have a phone number. I just keep getting voicemail.
Really? Yeah. So there is an answer there.
Yeah.
Oh.
But I got her number from one of the people from Sharon. So.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, so.
I mean, I don't think that there's I don't know where she is now.
Maybe I think she goes to Florida in the winter. I mean, I'm just assuming based on the community that she's from.
And you never heard back?
No.
Uh-huh.
I never actually left a message.
Uh-huh.
Because I wasn't sure if it was her.
Oh, you didn't
leave them? It was like an automated recording. It wasn't like
hi. Oh, really?
Hello.
Oh, you never left them?
Yeah.
Well, if you get desperate, you could leave a message.
Yeah, I'm going to try. Hoping to get in touch with her this summer.
Right. Great. Good.
This has been really helpful.
Oh, well, I don't know if it's, you know.
Well, I mean, we've learned. The thing is with this piano,
they're mostly anecdotal.
There's not much out there.
No.
So, I mean, anything we can probably find.
Yeah.
Is it possible? I guess there are probably programs from your performances in various archives. I mean, they're not,
yeah,
obviously not like 70 years old.
There's some programs. Yeah, you could.
Nice to track the limited performance history of this relatively early work.
You can ask. Well, we just know about the first two performances, you know, by the Madison and
right.
and then Raphael. I don't know if he played it with the composer. He may have. I know he played the fiddle sonata with the composer, but I don't know if he played the piano trio with the composer. You'll have to, if you. You might ask him about that.
Yeah.
I don't know if he did. He may very well have done it with the composer. They were very good friends.
Yes.
You know. Great.
Right. Well, thank you again.
Wow.
I guess I
didn't know this was
something about like what time.